This is Context Matters, and I am your host, Cindy Parker. Living abroad and traveling to different countries taught me to be aware that we all have cultural assumptions. When we remain embedded in our own cultural context, we are less likely to recognize the trappings of our own culture, and we assume other societies are just like us. This is why international travel is beneficial. You become aware of your cultural lenses. I enjoy talking with people from other places or those who have other beliefs than I have, even if in actuality it complicates things since we bring unspoken, invisible, and different assumptions to the table. It is not uncommon in these conversations for the other person to point out something that I've taken for granted. And I won't lie, sometimes my knee-jerk reaction is to go, "Nuh-uh, that's not true." But when I think of it, I realize, maybe they were right. That thing might belong to the cultural waters I swim in and I pick up and I didn't question because it just felt so natural. When someone questions me about it, I have to decide if I'm going to hold on to it or let it go. It's like I hit my boundaries of knowledge and I need to decide if I am more comfortable in my confines or if I'm willing to flex my mental muscles and expand my understanding. Even in my professional career, this process has been valuable to me, from understanding biblical archaeology and its influence on interpreting scripture, all the way to just crafting my personal theology. Most definitely, keeping yourself open to challenging conversations is difficult, but this is why I have such enormous respect for women like Rabbi Nancy, who have been national leaders in the multi-faith conversation. I was curious to find out from Rabbi Nancy an example of how studying with people from different faith backgrounds can challenge our perspectives on interpreting the Bible. We talked about how being patient enough to hear the other person explain their sacred text helps us understand our own assumptions. You'll hear more about that in a moment. My conversation with Rabbi Nancy began with talking about how 9/11 transformed how she understood what kinds of multi-faith conversations were essential to engage in and what kind of impact those initial conversations have had in the last few years.
And then, you know, one day, one sunny, beautiful day in September 2001, I was sitting at my desk at the Jewish Family and Children's Service, and the planes crashed into the World Trade Center. And, you know, like maybe 3 days later, it suddenly hit me. You know, first of all, I don't know anything about Islam. And I thought, I'm supposed to be training people to do multi-faith, but what's multi-faith? It's not Jewish-Christian. We have to get, like, a lot bigger very fast. And so I can't remember this part of it. I either made a phone call or I looked on a computer, and I'm not sure if it was possible to look on a computer at that time. But somehow I found out that there were a lot of books about Islam at the public library in Germantown. And I thought, I'll go to the public library in Germantown and get some books. And I remember driving down Germantown Avenue to look for the books, to get the books, right? And looking out the window and realizing that there were people walking on the street in abaya and hijab and burqa. And I was like, I had no idea. I live in a neighborhood where there are a lot of Muslims. I just don't know these people.
Right.
This was like 3 weeks after September 11th.
Isn't that so interesting how something can be present in your world and you don't see
it? I had never looked out the window. I was heading for the library to read the books, right? So then I thought, you know,
books.
There's actually people and they're dressed in this funny way. I think they are Muslims. Oh, okay.
Right.
That sounds unbelievable, right? Like really pathetic. And you can leave this part out, but a lot of it had to do with the fact that I live in Mount Airy, but I spent most of my time driving north.
Oh, sure.
Towards Chestnut Hill, towards the rabbinical school.
That's right.
Towards the suburbs, or yep. I'd hop on Lincoln Drive and go to Center City. But I hadn't actually driven down Germantown Avenue that way.
Right.
But I started doing that a lot more. And I started finding out who those people were. And then it's like, oh, I have a whole new lease on life here. So I came back to RRC.
Right. Bringing a new enthusiasm.
And I changed the name of the department to the Department of Multi-Faith Studies.
Yeah.
Out of Religious Studies. And I called it Multi-Faith Studies and Initiatives. Because I said, we're going to do initiatives. We're not just going to have classes. We're going to do things. We're going to have programs. We're going to have conferences. We're going to have retreats. We're going to serve other people. Because our rabbinical school turned out, after we started teaching about Muslims, was the only rabbinical school that was actually doing that. We did it in a really fun way. I partnered with the University of Pennsylvania Islamic Studies, actually Middle East Center, and we got grants and we had the Middle East students come talk with our students. And, you know, we did all kinds of fun things. And then I started getting a lot of grant money to do this for rabbinical students from other schools. Mm. So we ended up having 5 years of retreats, five big retreats of emerging Muslim and Jewish leaders. We left the Christians out of the picture because I just want to focus on this relationship of all the rabbinical schools from Orthodox to Renewal all came with people, representatives. We found emerging public intellectuals, people who were becoming Islamic studies professors, people who were becoming chaplains for universities, which was just beginning. Like, no, there were no Muslim chaplains who were full-time on a university, but there were people who were starting to be having the profile of someone who could do that. And over the years, we got to know a lot of Muslim young people, and they now have emerged, and a lot of them are leaders now. It's really exciting. Many of them on college campuses and other places. So that's kind of fun. And
Did you find equal enthusiasm for the conversation among the Muslim students as among your students here?
Well, yes. Although that faded after a while. We started to find it harder as things got more political around Israel-Palestine, and more Muslim people were saying that they were having a harder time with being in a program that felt like it was just ignoring that. That became a much more complicated and fraught issue.
Right.
Because we were just like, if you just don't pay any attention to the power and privilege differential and you just have – when we started this program – it was 2006, and we had these retreats in 2006, 2008, 2009, I think there was one in 2011. But towards the end, they got really, really fraught, I would say. Hard stuff started to come out because in the beginning, people were really enthusiastic about learning each other's texts and doing, learn this really wonderful. And we would start at the beginning, we'd say, we're not going to do anything about Israel. We're not going to talk about it. And, we make jokes about the elephant in the closet or something like that,
Yeah.
And then we would have like one session where we let people
vent or just kind of say
anything. But venting is really problematic. It's very problematic because it's easy to vent if you're the ones who've got the goods already, as far as the Muslims are concerned. The Jewish people were like, oh, it's so hard. We feel terrible. I'm like, really? Anyway, you can understand that became more fraught. But in any event, we did that work for a number of years, and I'm very proud of it. And then I had another grant where I worked on spiritual practices, got away from politics altogether, and we had retreats with people sharing spiritual practices, and we brought in Buddhists and Hindus and Baha'i, and we got more involved in all kinds of different religions. That was really fun. The intensity of the Jewish-Muslim thing got diffused because the retreats weren't about that. They were about spiritual practices.
Right.
And that's what we were talking about, and that's what we did. But that last grant was about campus chaplaincy and was very wonderful to me when I went. I just did a capstone event where I brought in leaders in the campus chaplaincy world to talk about what's happening on campus. And sure enough, a lot of them said that Israel-Palestine is blowing up their campuses, just blowing it up. And it's not Jewish-Muslim. It's intra-Jewish between the Jews who are BDS Jews and the Jews that are more traditional, conservative, Zionist, and the Muslims who want to be more involved.
Interesting.
People,
it's more complex and nuanced.
And it's
then,
more
right?
intra.
Yeah.
It's more intra. It's more like the division is not all the Muslims are for Palestine, all the Jews are for Israel. It's not like that. Got it? It's like there are lots of Jews on campus now who want nothing to do with Israel. They want to hang out with the Muslims who want to fight for Palestine. Just as for Palestine, people get along great. It doesn't matter what religion they are.
Right.
Zionists, you know, evangelical Christians who are Zionists, conservative Jews who are Zionists, they all get along fine. So, but I'm hearing that that's still a very fraught issue. But personally, it was very interesting to me was that I started to research who in the field really could talk about what campus chaplaincy should look like in the future, and how people should be trained for that, because increasingly the campuses are multi-faith. The context is not you're learning how to be the Episcopal minister for the Episcopalian students, or you're learning to be the Hillel rabbi for Jews, because increasingly you look at the profile of students coming into colleges, 40% don't sign up for any religion.
Right.
They're signing up for spiritual but not religious.
Right.
SBNR. Or they're signing up for none, N-O-N-E, or some, you know, nuns or sums. So the ministers and rabbis and imams and all the other people who are coming, religious counselors, clergy, non-clergy, people who are serving, they need a new name. Chaplain isn't even the right name. They're really spiritual advisors to a diverse group of people. And one of their main mission for them is to create a culture of pluralism on campus that allows people to be with one another in good ways across religion, across ethnicity, across class, and big, big, big time across race. So we're hearing more and more. So anyway, so I made sure I got the sort of leading Black person who was a campus minister training campus ministers in the Muslim community. And it turned out it was one of my people who had been in my first retreat when he was still an emerging leader.
Wow, that's
so
great.
So that was so fun. Yeah. That just happened. So because of my interest in Muslim-Jewish relations, about 6 years ago, I got a phone call from a woman named Cheryl Olitsky saying that she had this wacky idea that they should start a sisterhood of Salam Shalom, of Jewish and Muslim women. There would be chapters around the country that would meet once a month and get to know one another and build bridges between our communities. And we would address Islamophobia and anti-Semitism in our own communities. And then together, these women would go out and deal with anti-Semitism and Islamophobia in the society together as teams. So this was, you know, before Trump was elected. It was, as I said, about 5 years ago. They started with one or two chapters. Then there were five chapters. Then there were 10. I went on the founding board. I'm still on the board. And now there are 170 chapters.
Wow. All on the East Coast or spread everywhere?
No, spread everywhere. Spread all over the country and Canada. 10 of the chapters are teenage girls.
Fantastic.
Yeah. It's really great. We have every year we go on a trip. This past summer, we went to Auschwitz. They signed up 52 women, as I mentioned before. Jewish and Muslim women went to Berlin. Then we went to Warsaw, Krakow, and Auschwitz. It was a week and a half day trip, a week and a half together. Very intense. Really great. So I met a woman on that trip, a Muslim scholar. And I invited her to my home, and that she's my house guest now. So last night, I was going over with her the material that I'm going to be teaching at the conference this Sunday. And I'm teaching a class on Sarah and Hagar, and Hagar, who we have in the Torah, they have in the Quran, and we both have in our traditions in Midrash, and they have it in Hadith. And then, even more so, the Muslims have a Hagar thing going on that's huge, because part of the Hajj is repeating the steps of Hagar, when she ran back and forth looking for water. When her son was about to die, there were the story that they tell in the Hadith is that she saw her son was going to die of thirst, and she was racing back and forth between these two hills looking for water, which she eventually found. And every Muslim who comes on Hajj does this running back and forth like the woman. So this is a powerful thing that there's a woman's story that becomes the prototype of faith. And of it's not just sitting around waiting faith. It's faith where you actually run for it. And very beautiful. And it's part of the Hajj. So it's a big deal.
So Rabbi Nancy and I go on to talk about the patriarchs and the Abraham narratives. And I have to admit, as far as understanding how context changes the way we approach the narratives, well, I was sitting in the same room with Rabbi Nancy, and as we were talking, I could visualize the places of the narrative because of all the geographical work I've done in Israel-Palestine. So while she talked about Hagar in my head, I was already jumping into ancient Near Eastern cultural context in which foreigners like Abraham would not be allowed to own land and therefore they were disadvantaged, and how when you read the patriarchal stories, you can notice that Abraham is traveling in the shepherding territory or nomadic territory, and they're rarely ever present in settled areas. I was seeing a map in my head with the route Hagar would have taken when thrown out of Abraham's household. And then Rabbi Nancy took a turn in the conversation, one that was appropriate and totally validated by the text, but a turn nonetheless that reminded me that we all bring our own specializations and interests to the text we read. And honestly, this is why I love studying sacred texts with other people. But I will let you hear this for yourself.
Context is everything.
Yes, it is.
So what we know as Jewish women today, reading this story in the era of Me Too, and in the era of awareness of race and class, and the era of especially the way in which we understand power and patriarchy, we read this story, the Torah story, as intensely problematic, intensely problematic. I and my fellow Jewish feminists and Christian feminists, whom I know, read this story and see that Abraham basically is interested in his progeny taking over the promise, and he's going to use these women one way or another. The women end up being set against one another.
Right.
This is not how the story is told. The story is told in a way, honestly, that makes Sarah into something of a villain. I mean, she's jealous and she throws out her maidservant. But the way you can read this story in a number of ways, but the most intense reading of it, which I have chosen to read many times, is that Sarah says to Abraham, go ahead and rape my slave.
Wow.
That's not good stuff. That's not good stuff. It's not good that Abraham does it, right? And Abraham, of course, then tries to let the slave die and her son die, who also tries to kill his own son in the next chapter. Really interesting stuff. But from a feminist perspective, from a contemporary perspective, from a perspective that thinks about power the way we think about power, the feminist reading that I have been promoting for the longest time is that, you know, Sarah and Hagar are both victims of a system, and that they're set against each other the same way that it's often the case that the people who are getting the least out of a power system are made to hate each other rather than to hate the guy in charge.
Right.
And so that's been a very satisfying reading of the story to me. So last night I was sharing it with this Muslim scholar, and she was just appalled. She was offended. She was horrified because she feels that these women are the mothers of the faith. in Islam, Abraham can do no wrong. He's the friend of God. And she was unwilling to think in any way that Abraham could have any flaw. And she kept saying to me, well, how do Jews have their religion if even their great Abraham is flawed like that? Like, how can you, what if you don't think that there were once people, prophets, who exemplified what God wanted from their lives, how do you possibly think that you can do it? And I was like, I absolutely don't think Abraham was a model of anything. And my moral imperatives in my faith do not rely on the fact that there are people in the Bible for sure, or even anywhere, that actually exemplified these things perfectly.
Right.
And so we got into this whole conversation about saints and about, you know, her thing is the Islamic tradition, the prophets are perfect. They cannot do anything wrong, and you cannot challenge them. But then there was this whole other sort of Islamophobia responding thing going on where she was feeling like I, in my reading, didn't understand the way the Middle East worked and family structures, and that this wasn't really rape, that they were multiple wives, and that that was a good thing, and that Western people read these things.
She was upset that you were demonizing, or she viewed you as demonizing the women, and
well,
she didn't see
the system.
Oh.
Demonizing the system. I wasn't demonizing the women. I think the women were both victims.
Right, right.
But I was demonizing the system.
Yeah, saying the patriarchy is at blame.
Correct. And she was saying that's a Western critique of the way people in the Middle East have multiple wives, and you have to understand that she is based on – it started because she didn't want there to be anything wrong with her story.
Right.
Because as we got deeper and deeper into it, it became increasingly clear that she actually believes this story is divine in its basis, and I believe it is human in its detail and – maybe, you know, related to divinity and the fact of its inspiration and
right.
the way it's been passed down. But basically, I think it's a story. It's a story. And she really sees that, you know, the angel Gabriel gave this story to the prophet Muhammad, and it's a true story. But more importantly, it can't be a bad story about this family. And that's where we got into this. It was very multi-layered conversation, because that's where we got into this kind of like defensiveness about the Middle East and about how Westerners are one of the themes of Islamophobia, of which there are many. But one of the themes has to do with, well, you know, they don't treat women well.
Right.
And so this felt to her like another one of those, you know, these are Middle Eastern patriarchal,
right.
you know, she's trying to explain to me that like having multiple wives was what they did in those days, and it wasn't bad, and the women didn't mind. And I was like, well, whatever. Anyway, but it was so interesting because it was all about context and about what we assume the hermeneutic to begin with when we start reading the story. But she convinced me that I would offend many traditional women in my workshop, which I'm going to lead on Sunday, Muslim women, if I went in there and said Abraham raped his wife's slave.
Huh. Good to have the conversation ahead of time then.
Yeah.
Wow. So a lot of that is tied up in the hermeneutics, like you said, and kind of the follow-up question of why is this story in our sacred text, right? So if she is assuming the story is in the sacred text and it in and of itself is sacred and good.
Has to be.
Is different than you approaching saying it's
in
the text.
Because the people who canonized that text may not have had a critique of that, but I do.
Right.
And it's every generation has to bring their own questions to the text. And that doesn't make the text less holy in the sense that it reflects the generations of people who've chanted it with their yod in their hand.
Right.
And, you know, the tunes and everything. And it's all very beautiful. But I can bring as much suspicion and critique as I want to that text from my context. And I think that when it was canonized, I think there was something holy going on because it's like amazing, like how amazing it is. It's just there's something going on there. The Torah is an incredible, incredible document and the Quran as well. But that doesn't keep me from asking the harshest possible questions of
right.
it. But her position was that a good Muslim has to ask, has to look at the Quran, and they can do commentary on it, and they can think about it and try to expand upon it, but it has to be done only through a hermeneutic of generosity and of mercy and of assumption that its holiness is that it's all good. So I said the saddest part to me about this story is that in the end of the day, Sarah and Hagar never reconcile, even though Ishmael and Isaac do. And it drives me crazy that men and even women present this story and then they say, in the end, it's all good. Because when Abraham dies, even though it was so sad and it was like all this bad stuff that happened that went down, in the end of the day, at the burial of Abraham, you see Isaac and Ishmael both there. And I'm like, great, that's lovely. But where's Sarah? She's dead, right? I mean, we don't hear another word about Sarah after the binding of Isaac. Not one word, right? And where's Hagar? Okay, she's doing her thing. They're building the Kaaba according to the tradition of Islam. Fine. But it doesn't help me see that the women – so it's like – to me, it's such a male-centric story about how it's all about – the male's trying to figure out which male is going to be the head of the line. And then there's going to be another story, another line, but that'll be another male. But the women are like expendable in this story, in the Torah.
Right.
And so she was horrified by that. And she said, well, I don't think that's true. How do you know they didn't reconcile? Maybe they forgave each other in their hearts. Maybe they met up and had a reconciliation. I said, well, that's a really beautiful idea, and we can add that. And I'm not opposed to that, but I don't feel like I have to add that for the Torah to be holy. The Torah is holy to me, even if it leaves us with a story about brokenness. It's reflecting something about the world.
Yeah.
So that's my story about context.
Yeah. Have you read the same text with Christians?
Oh, yeah.
And do the Christians bring a whole different perspective as well?
Usually very anti-Semitic, I actually find.
Oh, really?
I find feminist Christian readings of this to be quite anti-Semitic. I think they really trash Sarah as being sort of the chauvinist and wanting her kid to be the chosen kid and blah, blah, blah. And they glorify Hagar as the single mother, especially like in African-American writing about this when they want to claim Hagar, which I totally appreciate and love that they want to do that. But it also often has like a little bit of a Sarah the slave owner, Sarah the Jewish white lady. And, you know, it's like it does set up a very problematic thing, and not much sympathy for Sarah.
Yeah.
Even with feminists, like they're so busy with like Hagar's a single mother and Hagar's a slave and Hagar's from Egypt, so she's black, she's this, she's that. And they don't show a lot of sympathy in my experience often for Sarah, who also is, in my view, not a powerful person in that story.
Right.
Her only power comes if she produces sons.
Right.
And when she's not producing sons, she's terrified. And remember also that Abraham, when he wanted to save their lives, he put her in a harem.
Right.
He was willing to sacrifice her everything to be in there.
Right.
And we don't know what happened to her in there. Oh, and by the way, in the Torah story, this is really interesting. In the Torah story, it says that Abraham said, she's my sister. This happens twice, as you
know.
And it never says whether she's actually violated or not.
Right.
But nobody could live with that. The Jews couldn't live with that. The Muslims couldn't live with that. So in the Midrash, they explicitly say, but she got out before he could do anything. He tried, but he couldn't. He couldn't get it up. I mean, there's like really funny Midrash stories about how, you know, like Satan came and started to whip him just as he was about to, you know, whatever. And then Muslim tradition in the Hadith has a very similar kind of thing. They want to make absolutely certain that nobody thinks that
Pharaoh tried to sleep with her or rape her.
The
king of Gerar.
King of Gerar. The two of them, neither one of them ever got a chance to get really close to her. So they also come up with a whole story about how there was this distraction. He was just about to do it, but then there was this noise and then he had to look away. And then it's just, and they're very similar. So that is actually hilarious because to me, all of this is about people trying to fix the stories to make them work for them. So in their context, in both of these traditional contexts, they were worried that Sarah would be violated, that would make her purity less or something, you know, because she is.
Yeah.
It's only after that she becomes the mother of Isaac. Now, remember, Abraham was old and Isaac was suddenly, miraculously, she has Isaac. So what the tradition, Jewish tradition, does to fix this story, believe it or not, is that after the Akedah, the binding of Isaac, there's a tradition, and it's in Rashi, it's a well-attested midrash, that Abraham marries Hagar. That's supposed to fix everything. Yeah.
Huh.
That he goes and marries her.
Right.
To make up for having thrown her out and almost killing her and whatever. And Sarah has died because she dies of fright. That's in the midrash also. That a Satan comes to her and says, you know what Abraham's doing? And even though he doesn't end up doing it, when he's about to do it.
The binding of Isaac, correct. Meaning she dies of fright that her husband is going to kill her only child.
Right. Right. She's terrified by that and drops dead and then doesn't ever get resurrected. She's dead. But in fact, the story goes on. He didn't die. But then he marries Hagar and everything's supposed to be good then. Because Abraham's married Hagar now. I mean, they're trying to fix things in their context. But as a feminist and a woman in our context, we see all the problems. But I don't know if this is sort of irrelevant to you maybe because you're not getting deep into the Muslim tradition of interpretation. But Muslims do not, apparently, I've heard this before and I certainly heard it last night, it's very painful for them to contemplate anything untoward about the prophets.
Yeah.
And they really do revere Abraham and Sarah and Hagar.
Yeah.
And they do not think that Sarah and Hagar had any stuff between them. This was just how Allah wanted it to be. Allah had a plan for this whole thing. The plan was that they were going to have two peoples. The two peoples needed to separate. They needed to go different places.
Yeah.
This was, you know, where she was exiled to is where the Kaaba is.
Right.
That's where her exile was. And so it's all meant to be. And that's just the way it is. But I come to this with a tremendous belief that stories about human brokenness can also be holy stories.
Yeah, I agree.
So?
It is fascinating to me that we could have... So maybe not the Quran changes some of the stories from the Torah, like similar characters, but the way the stories turn out is a little bit different. But Christians can read the Torah. Like I could sit with you as a Christian scholar and you as a rabbi, we could read the Torah together. And I wonder if we would be actually reading the same thing.
Right. Right. Well, it depends on the story, but for sure, yeah, really different.
Yeah. I mean, even just bringing our assumptions or our theological training or conversations we've had with other people or life experiences.
Right.
But we could read the same words in black and white and think they mean something totally different.
And it's not just about being Jewish and Christian, because there's Christians who read it as the divine word of God.
Right.
And there are Jews that read it as that. And then there are Christians who read it strictly historically. But even if we were two people who both read it incredibly historically, critically, without anything other than this is a mythic, folkloristic thing. There was never any of these people. None of them ever existed. There's all just, you know, stories, prototype. They're like Greek myths or something. Even if we read it that way, as a Jew and as a Christian, we would read it differently because we're invested in thinking about our issues. And I'll give you a great example of that. There is the first Rashi, you know, Rashi.
Yes. So
the very first one is on Genesis 1, and it's, you know, the creation of the world. So what would you think if you were reading the creation of the world? You'd think, oh, this is a very good place to start. Why not? Where else would you start but the creation of the world? Right. That'd be obvious, right? So his first question at Genesis 1 is, why does the Torah start here? Why doesn't it start in Exodus 12? Because this is a question for him. Like, to him, the Torah was about the Jewish people right. and what they have to do. And Exodus 12 is the first place where there's a command to the Jewish people.
Huh.
And it has to do with keeping Passover.
Yeah.
It's before the Exodus happens. And they say, you know, bring a lamb and slaughter it. That's the first plural command to the Jewish people to do something. And as far as he's concerned, that's what the Torah is about. It
right.
should be about. And so he has this weird question. Why would you start with all this business about creating the world? Who cares?
Yeah.
Like, and then what's about all these forefathers? Who the hell are they? Like, they're just a family with a lot of weird dysfunction. And, you know, like, why do we have to have right. all this in our Bible? Shouldn't right. the Bible be a law book? So that's fascinating. But the thing that's so weird is that he asked this bizarre question, which no Christian would ask, because a Christian would think to themselves, well, Exodus 12 is about the start of the Jewish people, but like, so what? You know, like, the main thing is we want to know, how did the world create?
Right.
Who was the first believer? Abraham, you know, we reckoned it to him for faith, you
right.
know, like, and it's not just about a dysfunctional family. It's about everything that you need to know. But then what's even weirder is his answer.
What is his answer?
Well, his answer you would think would be because we want to know how the world came to be, or we want to know that God is in charge of the whole world or something like that, just whatever. And his answer is, because it's important to know that God created the whole world so that we know that he also created the land of Israel and that he can give it to whoever he wants, and he gave it to the Jews.
Huh. Interesting.
So it's a Zionist polemic.
Yeah.
In the first Rashi, in the entire Rashi thing, you know, five books of Torah commentary. So apparently that was a question, context. Why was that a question in France in the 13th century? I have no idea. But apparently it was, because that was what he wants to talk about. He's saying he's interested in proving to you that the Jews own the land of Israel, regardless of the fact that they're not there. And Zionists love this particular Rashi because it brings up to them that, yeah, all through history, even though we were absent from the Holy Land, we knew we owned it. We knew that God had given it to us. And he says specifically, he says, God created it so God can take it and give it to whoever he wants. And he gave it to us. And they want to just remember that. It's their land.
Yeah.
It's very scary. I mean, horrible. So like, from my context, I don't believe any of that. I think that's all awful stuff. And I don't believe that God gave land to different people. And what's really interesting, though, that is that even if you do believe that, you have to look at Deuteronomy, where he says he'll take it away again if you didn't like what you're doing. They don't like that part so much. But
right. It's conveniently choosing to
things. It's not given as a, you know, whatever you do, you've got it.
Right.
So that, but that makes things much harder. Anyway. Yeah.
So context matters, not only for us, but for the people in our faith traditions who have translated our texts and who have established the foundations for our systematic beliefs. And this part is so fascinating to me. We will have to dive into more issues like this in future podcasts, because sometimes we're not fully aware of how the commentary by scholars in the third century and about issues not explicitly addressed in the Bible end up defining our modern beliefs. And this isn't true only of Christians. I think there are people in all faiths who have different ideas about what the text is trying to do.
Rabbi Nancy's associate thinks that the text is displaying how people are perfectly loving God. Some people will say that a text is almost dictated by God, and so therefore it is prescribing the behavior of humans. In other words, the text is trying to say, this is how it should be. Others, like Rabbi Nancy, say the text was written by people. Divinely inspired, yes, but a human document. And so we should be allowed to look back on an older society that is different than ours and critique it. Of course, I adore the fact that Rabbi Nancy brought up Deuteronomy at the end of our conversation because that's my specialty. And I always say everything starts and ends with Deuteronomy. Music was arranged by Peter Lawrenson of Sycamore Sound. And if you would like more information about Rabbi Nancy or about becoming a partner with me on Patreon, go to the podcast page of my website, www.narrativeofplace.com. This episode of Context Matters was brought to you by Patreon supporters like Michelle and David Kaufman. Thanks for being here. I will see you next week.